Good day, UBS. Dan Cassidy here. As we have been highlighting, we are back now with the next installment of our ongoing Portfolio Manager series right here on UBS On Air. Our conversation for today will focus on the investment landscape and positioning considerations when it comes to emerging markets. So with that, joining me right here at the table in the 1285 podcast studio, I'm glad to welcome from our partners at Lazard Asset Management, Rohit Chopra. Rohit is a portfolio manager and analyst on the Emerging Markets Equity and Emerging Markets Core Equity team with a focus on consumer and telecommunications research and analysis. Rohit, great to be with you here at the table. Thank you for dropping by and for spending some time today with our financial advisors.
Thank you, Dan. Looking forward to today's conversation.
Absolutely. So perhaps to set the stage a bit, Rohit, how would you assess the evolution of the emerging markets asset class? Today's EM, so to speak, still dependent on a commodity super cycle to outperform, such as what we saw back in the early 2000s. What perhaps has changed about the composition of the asset class?
Dan, emerging markets, there's never a dull moment. This is an asset class that continuously evolves. Complexity is going up. Broadly speaking, emerging markets in the 90s were an asset class that was just opening up. It was going from self-sufficiency to places being starved for capital. You had a very strong initial return, but then we had this period of dominoes of currency devaluations across the emerging markets. In the 2000s, as you're aware, China joins the World Trade Organization, and it carried the emerging markets in a virtuous cycle where U.S. consumer drove fixed asset investment in China that drove the commodity complex that improved and highlighted emerging markets in a highly correlated asset class. The last decade, I would describe it as the lost decade for emerging markets. This was a period where growth differentials in the emerging markets fell relative to that of developed markets. We had a ROE premium or financial productivity premium that fell, and it was difficult. You had a strong dollar that impacted non-U.S. assets, and EM essentially had a lost decade. Going forward, I'm actually quite excited about where we are. I think we're actually at a point where EM is not necessarily the EM of 20 years ago, but really looking forward, we see a lot of opportunities to be active. It is a opportunity for idiosyncratic or stock pickers like myself to really identify key areas. You think about China and sort of the evolution of its economy away, I think, from fixed asset investment and much more towards renewables, autonomous vehicles. They're driving healthcare as well. So there's a lot of sort of shifts that are occurring. Think about India, for example. This is a market that is at a very important inflection point. When I started investing in EM over 20 years ago, this was a period where per capita incomes in India were less than $400. Today, we're getting closer to the $2,500 level. And that's important because that means the middle class is about to come online. And that means that you're going to see, I think, a deepening of the asset class. Air travel is happening. Consumption is occurring. People are buying homes for the first time. There's positive real wage growth. So the path and that evolution of the economy is moving more and more towards lower middle class income. At the same time, I think if you look around the Middle East, there's an air of reform, competition for talent. Particularly in places like the United Arab Emirates and Saudi, where we're seeing a very healthy level of competition and a really diversification away from the commodities alone and deepening of that economy. Think about Latin America. I'd say here that we have a period of an asset class and a consumer that hasn't really seen a credit cycle. I think you look at where real rates are. Central bankers across Latin America have shown orthodoxy. They've kept rates high. And as we get some clarity in terms of U.S. interest rate policy, I think we're going to start to see the development of a credit cycle. And I think that's going to be really powerful in terms of driving financial inclusion. So what you see here is that there is a lot of great, exciting, fundamental things that we see across emerging markets. Broadly speaking, we're talking about an asset class that over the next 15 years are going to see more than 2 billion people join the global economy. And we think that there's an opportunity to be active here.
Very helpful context as you took us across the world with that assessment and clearly a lot of different avenues one could explore when it comes to investing in the emerging markets. I'm curious what would need to happen for emerging markets to enter a sustained period of outperformance versus developed markets. I know many investors have gone away from a dedicated EM allocation, bringing their allocation down to zero or playing EM through an international mandate. Why should investors have a dedicated allocation to emerging markets? What's the investment case?
So I think a lot of that behavior is rearward view, viewing in terms of the asset class. I think actually going forward, there's a lot to be excited about. First of all, emerging markets as part of global capitalization is less than 10%, despite the fact that it represents over 80% of global populations and fast-moving economies in terms of economic growth. Markets have become quite skewed, particularly in the developed markets. In emerging markets, I think what you're starting to find is that there's a lot of diversity that exists. We have parts of emerging markets that are driving the fourth industrialization. Think within the technology areas, semiconductors, memory. These are some of the leading companies in the world. In markets like India, you're seeing the development of consumer class. So I think what you're actually seeing here is the case to be active in EM is not to do crossover from a developed market and multinationals. There's actually innovation that's happening from the ground up in these countries that are and companies that are well placed. We are the view that you're not buying India Inc. or Brazil Inc. You're actually investing in businesses. And I would say today the starting point is quite attractive. Emerging markets are at over a 30% discount to developed markets. You're seeing an improvement in growth differentials. What was historically a major headwind for EM around the strong dollar, I think, becomes less of a headwind. And I think that's really where the opportunity exists as we start to see the deepening of these markets. The risk-reward, in our opinion, looks quite attractive for the emerging markets.
So as far as putting money to work, just looking at your process a bit, what kind of companies do you look for in managing bottom-up portfolios, and how would you characterize the businesses you look for?
I've been with Lazard now for over 26 years. I started off as an analyst focusing on fundamentals, covering the financial sector and broadening out to portfolio management. Over this entire 20-year-plus experience, Lazard has been very key core in terms of its belief system. We are a firm that believes in fundamental investing. In particular, we believe in the concept of financial productivity, which is the company's returns. Think of a return on equity, return on invested capital. How are they actually behaving as stewards of capital? And have a context of valuation in place. And we believe it's the trade-off between those two that is what's quite attractive. In investing and using our framework, we would broadly say that we see opportunities in emerging markets in two types of businesses. Compounders, which I would argue today in emerging markets look quite attractive. Essentially, these are leading industry companies in the emerging markets. They tend to be category winners. They have a durable competitive advantage. There's a significant moat. And very often, the market is discounting their sustainability of growth going forward. And we would argue that they're able to compound those returns for a lot longer. The demand dynamic that exists is much deeper than the markets often discount. And then there's about the other type of businesses that we find across EM are within the mispricing. So these are where we would argue that the market multiple is incorrect for that level and stability of financial productivity. And here is trying to understand the path for the companies to unlock some of that intrinsic value in terms of improvement in corporate governance. The market, I think, needs to see some signs of sustained profitability. But those two generally are the types of business that we find very much fundamentally driven. We recognize there's a lot of complexity out there, particularly around the macro and geopolitical context. We use the broader EM platform at Lazard to help us assess those issues. It's in an integrated manner. And there we're thinking about geopolitics, strong dollar, interest rate differentials, and then at the same time understanding the context of tariffs, which have clearly been impacting headlines and short-term asset prices. But as long-term investors, we believe that fundamentals using this framework around financial productivity and valuation can allow us to unlock or realize some of those market inefficiencies.
So getting a bit more pointed on U.S. trade policy, mindful as well, tomorrow, November 5th, will commence the IEEPA hearings of the Supreme Court. That will be something to watch for. But just coming off of the trip last week from President Trump, meeting with President Xi of China, any takeaways from that summit and thoughts on how that relationship could evolve from here?
So I'm generally optimistic. I think it's a very positive signal that the two largest economy leaders are speaking with each other. I think they understand the context of mutual cooperation. I think there's a lot that one can work on that front. And I think it's a positive sign for policy, both in terms of our initiatives here in the U.S. to make sure that we have fair trade and we're encouraging next generation investment and addressing some of the supply chains, particularly from a national strategic context. At the same time, I think the context for China is that understanding the level playing field. And what we find is that quite uniquely is that companies in the emerging markets are able to navigate through these periods better often than some of their developed market peers. So when we look at some of the innovation that's coming out of, for example, in China, it's quite staggering. Today, over 50% of new vehicle sales in China are coming in the form of EVs. We've seen significant out-licensing agreements between biotech companies in China with those here in the U.S. So I think there's a lot of potential cooperation, but clearly we have to be watchful and understanding of how these discussions continue to progress. 1 year is sort of what we're hearing right now in terms of the pause. But I think it's definitely a positive sign to see that there is some cooperation and the two leaders are working and getting the right people to iron out some of those details.
And for U.S. investors considering an allocation into China, what are some thoughts when it comes to approach, any guidance there, and what about risk considerations to be mindful of?
So I think that in the context of just investing in emerging markets, diversification. This is an asset class that's not monolithic. There are benefits of having diversification across different countries, and I think that's more and more apparent going forward. I think the other aspect is having a manager that is spending time meeting with these companies, going beyond financial journalism, meeting competitors, understanding the fundamentals of the business, having a framework, I believe, that is rooted in fundamentals that can assess some of those geopolitical challenges, but have conviction where often market volatility can create opportunities. But you have to have the conviction and do the diligence to be able to take advantage of those mispricings.
Rohit, thank you again for dropping by. It is a very exciting space to be in and a lot we can follow up on. Any final thoughts, takeaways before we close out today?
Yeah, I just would say I think this is think long term for emerging markets. There's a lot of exciting things that are going on. Having diversification is quite important, but really, really being part of that journey. And I think the journey over the next 15 years for emerging markets is quite exciting, particularly coming off of what I would describe as the last lost decade recently for the asset class. And here, active management, in my opinion, will be the key to unlocking some of the returns for investors.
Well, Rohit, would be great to have you back at some point. Thank you again, very generous with your time, for dropping by the studio, spending some time with our listeners and keeping them informed on what's going on across emerging markets and how to think about positioning within. It was great speaking with you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights, at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA SIPC.